Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 176 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. Second Wave podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and tonight we have an ACP roundtable. And our cast of crew is, of course, filling in as emergency holographic co-host, because Aaron Paulette is still on sabbatical. We have Jake the Egghead.
It's only a model.
We, of course, also have David.
Hello.
And we have currently buying a Raven 25 Oddball.
Well, and I'm also thinking, I already have a few 92s. I may need to buy a 92.
Yes.
I mean, you're enough of a fanatic of that horrible system that why would you not double down and buy the worst version of the worst gun?
Yeah.
Although I'm just looking forward to, in about 2-3 years, buying a Smith & Wesson Mark made in Tennessee.
That'd be pretty cool.
It will be.
That would be cool. But I'll tell you right now, in my own defense, I have a type 53, I believe it is, whatever the Chinese Mosin Nagant. It is the worst version of the worst gun.
Yeah, but I mean, Mosins are like Mosins. That's part of what you're collecting is how sugar they are.
Exactly. It's
except for the Finnish reworked ones are pretty good.
Well, yeah, I know, and those that's the best version of the worst.
Well, as
most people are just like, I got this for $65.
Yes, sir. How little did you spend on that rifle?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Wally has like do you own? Some sort of like Finnish like target model. Like it had like this.
Oh yeah,
it had like a crazy diopter sight on the back of it, and like all I can't even remember exactly what other like target stuff that was bolted on onto it, and I'm just like looking at it and I'm just like just trying to figure it out on the it's still a Mosin. I'm trying to even remember if it was off of a captured receiver or not, but he was like, yeah, that is significant. That's officially as much polish as you can slap on a turd.
Now, it was the rear target sight, was it mounted to the cocking piece?
No, I would have remembered that,
because they did that for a time.
Crazy.
That sounds like a really weird way to. Oh, ooh.
That sounds like
extending the sight radius. They did that on 03 Springfields.
It seems like a good way to get a wandering zero.
Yeah, exactly. How is that repeatable?
I do not claim to support this concept.
Okay. Sounds like somebody got visited by the good idea fairy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was a lot of that back in the day. Most countries grew out of it, not all.
I mean, if you want a severely polished one, here we go.
I did have a Mosin back in. Oh, wow.
That is very polished.
Yeah, that's actually...
And a hex receiver, too.
The Finnish Defense 762 TKIV 85.
Yeah, the...
Short for, I'm not even going to try it.
Yeah, it's Finnish. We just don't.
But it's a sharpshooter's rifle that the Finnish Army is still using and is currently looking for a replacement for.
Although I do like that the top handguard is held on with what looks like hose clamps.
Yep. I mean, the barrel bands on the original Mosin kind of, you know, were not much.
Not much more
substantial.
Not at all, but. You know, the Finns have a reputation for making do.
Yeah. No, I actually had a Mosin that I wish I hadn't sold. It was in pretty good shape, but then I had to be an idiot, and I pulled the rear sight off, and there was a dovetail underneath, the rear sight, there was a dovetail underneath it. I clamped a pick rail on there and threw a, like, $70 NC Star long eye relief scope on it, made a little scout rifle.
Just as good.
It was kind of fun, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, because you can always put everything back.
Yeah, it was like a minute of pie plate, you know? It's fine. It was kind of fun to shoot.
I had an opportunity years back at a Westinghouse Mosin.
Oh.
Yeah, a fellow I worked with, his father-in-law, who lived in New Jersey, decided that he'd had enough with trying to comply with their laws, and so he was just going to... He just gave his son-in-law, my coworker who lived in New York, all of his rifles... or all of his long guns, I should say. And one of them, one of them was a Krag Jorgensen carbine, which I advised him to hang on to for the investment. But there was a Westinghouse hex receiver Mosin that I was very tempted by.
All the Westinghouses were hexes. They're all 1891s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they were all hex, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. No, the round receiver didn't come out until thereabouts of World War II for the 9130s. So yeah, they're all the way up until the late
Winter 1930s. War,
they were all hex. Yeah. And then after that point, unless it's a reworked gun, some of them were like, you know,
the Dragoons.
Yeah, exactly. That were reworked into a new pattern. Some of the M38s were also cut down.
Yeah, but this thing was like it just came out of the Westinghouse factory and then been stored fairly well.
And why didn't you grab it?
Because I was asked to appraise them, and the value at that time that I appraised it for was more than I could readily afford.
Mm-hmm.
I could have lowballed him on it and then bought it, but that would have been dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Just like I got an email recently from someone whose father passed away and he wants to help me value some of the handguns.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I wouldn't mind having that one, but if I give him an accurate value, depending on the pictures, it's probably going to be more than I can afford.
Because
that's how I roll.
Yep.
Let me know and I might be able to buy it, and at least you can come play with it every so often.
But yeah, one of the crown jewels of my Mosin collection is a Westinghouse. I still need a Remington. I want both the an example of both the American Mosins.
Actually, I need to do is I need to get like a Remington Model 8.
Mm.
Because that would go along nicely with my Remington Model 11 from 1920 and my Remington Model 51 from 1919.
Nice.
I would have all three of that generation Remington autoloaders.
And also what I need to figure out is I need to figure out exactly what the story is behind my Westinghouse. I've heard a bunch of theories that all seem to add up. Is that mine is missing the top handguard, which is not unusual for 1891s. They're super duper fragile and they probably broke at some point, but it could have been purposely removed because stuck on the end of my barrel, clamped onto the end of my barrel, is a U.S. Craig Jorgensen bayonet lug.
Huh.
And the closest suspicion I have is that obviously the story behind the Remingtons and the Westinghouses was that Tsar Nicholas decided he needed to get a bunch more guns to supply his army, and so he put in contracts to both Remington and Westinghouse to produce a bunch of Mosin Nagants for him, and right in the middle of it, some jerk named Lenin decided to take over his government, and because of that, the Tsar, on account of getting held hostage and then murdered, ended up reneging on his payments. And so Westinghouse and Remington kept most of their Mosins and disposed of them in various ways. And
a good chunk of them were purchased by the U.S. government to help keep them afloat and then were used as training rifles.
Exactly. And so because of that Krag bayonet lug, which of course would be the infantry gun at the time, mm-hmm. of this, because this was
1890s.
Yeah. No, it was the early
1900s. No, the rifles were made in the 1890s.
Well,
when the Krag was the standard rifle, or prior to the 03 Springfield.
Correct. And so the idea that they could stick a blade bayonet on the end of it instead of using one of the spike bayonets. I don't know. I just need to try to figure out how I can track down where its path. Obviously, it didn't wander too far because it was made in Massachusetts, and I found it in a gun shop in Massachusetts. So,
have you been to the 762x54R website?
I have,
and they couldn't help you.
No, not any of the resources. I didn't go. Do they have a forum or?
Yeah, there's a web forum.
Yeah, I didn't go there, but oh well.
Oh. So, before Jake turns into a pumpkin, we should probably do a little bit of show stuff.
Mm. Actually, yeah. before we do that,
I tried, Jake.
Now, real quick, I
mean, this is all valid show stuff, so yeah, you know,
it is all valid show stuff. That's the point of a roundtable. It's rough and edgy.
I just wanted to say I was at the Music City MultiCon this past weekend, and ran into a fan of the show.
Nice.
So, who is also a podcaster, Brent from the Broken Token, which is a podcast about classic arcade games and pinball.
Ooh.
So, did you put a link in the show notes for their podcast?
I will shortly.
Yeah, make that happen, because that's
before or after you buy that Raven.
Either way. But yeah, I ran into him and talked to him for a little while, and seemed like a good guy. And if that's something you're interested in, check out his podcast.
I am interested, so it's in the show notes, so I can listen to it. That's really cool.
Cool.
So yeah, so. We got to kick it off. If certain people had prepared their segments, first up, let me say Steve was a good boy, and he got his segment in on time. David, I'll get a segment for y'all.
Yeah, I've got most of my segment. It's pretty much all written. Then I had to deal with more estate stuff, and knocked the wind out of my sails.
Well, there you go, having an excuse.
I also, at the last minute, had to put together two presentations for said Music City MultiCon.
All right, that's a valid excuse, too. And guess what?
I still don't know if my mother's tombstone has been placed.
Son of a...
Yeah, I called them last week. They said, oh, well, we'll get it in on Friday if the weather's good. And I said, well, can you call me and let me know? Sure, absolutely. Guess what didn't happen? Didn't call me. Yep, so I tried calling today and left a message.
Do you have any boots on the ground up there?
In the city, yes, but to ask them to get out to Long Island, where the cemetery is, that's a little bit much of an ask. Mm. And then got confirmation also that Thursday the truck is showing up with items from my mother's apartment that are coming to me. So, one of which will be my new-to-me desk. Means that I've already emptied out the desk drawers. And I'm going to be disassembling my computer and taking everything off this holy crap, this crowded desk. Put the desk together, but it's a roll top, so I will have space for two monitors on top.
Nice.
Actually, I'd have room for three monitors, but I'd have no way to actually send a signal to all three of them easily.
Can you get like a docking station or something?
I have a desktop. So I would have
Okay. You'd have to get like an extra graphics card or something, right?
Yeah. USB adapter.
Huh? Yeah, I could do the, actually I have two.
Yeah. I started rocking the three monitor setup a little bit ago, and it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I want to switch over to three. I'm going to see if I've been dreading talking to anybody about the cost of building a new computer.
No. Yeah.
I
stopped looking at video cards almost a year ago.
This machine downstairs, a little while ago, I actually sized back down to two monitors, but one of the monitors is 42 inches. So,
I mean, we got the supply chain backup of everything in general. Mm-hmm. We have the Bitcoin and crypto driven. Just run on anything with processing power.
Yep.
And then we have now the chip shortage on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, actually, we also have the sand shortage.
Yes.
Wait, whoa. We actually have a sand shortage?
Yes. Well, we have a sand shortage.
There's plenty of sand.
Yeah. It's just really expensive to ship around. I listened to a whole podcast on it, actually.
Yeah. I forget whether it was East or West Coast, but. One of the beaches that is known for its fine sand actually had to put guards because somebody was showing up with getting dump trucks full of sand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to a whole podcast on this and I thought it was really funny. It was, and I just figured it was going to be in the future. I didn't realize it was going to happen quickly.
No. It's been affecting the supply chain since June.
Wow.
And the big thing with that is the glass for laptop screens and touch screens.
And house
windows. Also silicon.
Which is made from sand, of course. But yeah, we had our windows replaced earlier this year, and our installation was delayed by about 2 months, 3 months. Yeah, 2 months, because they couldn't get the glass because the windows were made to order.
Yeah, I have due to my day job, I have a monthly meeting with Dell, which is usually a roadmap type meeting. And lately, it's for the past like year, it's been okay. What are you guys having shortages on this month?
So now every broken window at a protest is just going to be that much harder to fix now, huh?
Yep.
Great.
But for several months, there's been shortages on glass, on chips, on capacitors.
Yeah. Anything and everything.
Wouldn't have seen capacitors coming.
There's actually a point, and if people don't believe me, they can go check. Dell recently changed their docking stations. And the only change they made was they removed the analog audio jack on the docking station. And it was because they couldn't get the specific capacitor that they needed.
Hmm. Oh my God, that's hilarious. Yeah. Well, because capacitors are like pennies a piece.
Yeah.
Like, surely you'd think Dell would be able to buy them for $1 a piece, you know?
If they're not there to buy.
Yeah, that's just wild.
It's kind of like, I forget the name of the Ray Liotta movie where he was a prisoner stuck on an island that had...
No escape.
No escape, yeah. Where the escape plan was being held up by, what was the part that was there? You know, one car part, and I'm blanking out on what it was. But the guy building it went, yeah, you know, civilization, I could go down and buy this for $15 at the local auto shop. But
yep. But if you don't have it, you don't have it. That makes sense. It's just weird because capacitors, it's like. You can almost improvise those.
Yeah.
You know, like you can take two capacitors that are twice the capacitance and parallel them. You can put two that are half the capacitance and put them in series. You could.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of nonsense that goes into and having to modify your circuit boards and da 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 da.
Right. Yeah.
But it's just weird to me. You know, you'd think that there'd be some clever guy who would just figure out a way around it, you know?
Yeah. And like you said, there's workarounds, but. In that particular case, it was they actually talked to us about, so how big of a deal would it be for you guys not to have that on your docking stations?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you probably already have it on your laptop, right?
Yeah, your laptop has one.
Yeah.
So it's just that's...
Yeah, and I guess, like, Dell making actual professionally is not going to be open to the same kind of hacks that some, like... ham radio nerd like me might do on my own equipment if I actually knew how to do it.
Right.
But yeah, no, that kind of makes sense. It's just really funny that they actually had a whole design change. Like they had to probably change the enclosure. I mean, that was probably actually quite a production for them to make that design change. That wasn't just a,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I haven't looked at our new docks to see if there's just a blank stuck in the hole of the enclosure or what, because they may have just gone with we'll fabricate a blank and stick that in there as part of the assembly.
Yeah, and then you could still use the same PCB, you just don't populate all the parts
right
for that component, and then you just like slap it all together and put a plug in there. Okay, that would make sense. In that case, that probably could be something improvised. I was thinking of having to like redesign the PCB to remove the audio jack from it and design a new enclosure and do all the proper introductions. Or
I think you're just making up letters at this point in time.
Sorry. Manufacturing.
No. Yeah. That, it just is just we don't have these parts getting soldered onto the board.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Crazy. But
someone's going to like take apart one of these docking stations in like 30 years. I'm going to be like, what the
fudge
happened here?
Right. Assuming we're not all wearing colanders on our heads.
No, I mean, they'll be taking it apart in the post-apocalyptic wasteland, trying to salvage it for, you know, like little bits of lead that they can melt into bullets to fend off the zombies. But, you know, they'll still be a little curious as to why there's an unpopulated section of the circuit board.
Maybe not. But what the topic that I really wanted to dive into is, again, with the case of the shooting on the set of the movie Rust by at the hands of Alec Baldwin. There's more information coming in, and let's see, which one do I want to start with? Well, so
the ship sandwich is now a triple decker.
Yes.
Right.
The armorer is speaking out. So actually, interestingly enough, I will lead that, Alec Baldwin has never stopped speaking. Many, yeah. many lawyers and other people are pointing out, why are you doing this, man?
Like, just shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Just he ran off to, evidently he's either renting a place or owns a place somewhere up in northern Vermont, and should be just laying low. But I think it was actually just this morning or yesterday, a bunch of reporters flagged him down, and he pulled over like at the side of the road and told the reporters that he couldn't talk about the case, and then started talking about the case.
Because he can't not.
Yeah.
And he was making some stupid tweet, I think, about Halloween, just like some random thing.
Yep.
And people were kind of giving him grief about it. And I'm like, dude, how do you not understand? You need to just disappear.
Yeah.
Like, just don't be anywhere for the next, like, several months.
Yes.
Well, and I think I have a little bit different take on the spread of blame than Weird does, but
yeah,
continue.
But yeah, so but on the other hand, the polar opposite of that, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the daughter of Thel Reed and the armorer for this show, has released a statement through her lawyer. And she is essentially, she is saying that she was not on set at the time, which is very, very interesting. And I have heard, several film armorers that have essentially said, no, you don't do that. If there's guns on set, you're on set. If, if you're not on set, that means there's no guns on set or nobody's filming.
It's your literal job.
Yeah.
Like, right, that's what they pay you for.
Mm-hmm. And, I believe she is in this report. I'm trying to find if there's actually a good quote to read, but but it sounds like she is essentially tossing the director, the assistant director under the bus for this one, and essentially saying that it was his job to double check to make sure that the firearm that she was putting out for that were safe, and so she allegedly had checked it. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those. I'm not necessarily.
There's so much, again, misinformation.
Yeah,
it's everyone is putting in their two cents, most of whom don't have one sense of information.
For example, I hadn't seen it confirmed that she was not on set when it happened.
I've seen it. I saw it in at least one report, but I never saw any confirmation.
Yeah.
There's also report that she wasn't allowed inside the building where the scene was being rehearsed because of COVID restrictions, which is where the incident actually happened. Again, okay. I don't have confirmation about that.
Right.
That can't be. No, what? Man. That's true. I'm going to be so, like, I'm going to blow my stack.
Well, actually, and
it wouldn't
and
be that, the stupidest thing.
That does match up with some things that have been confirmed, in that the assistant director went out and there was a tray of three guns to be used. He chose one of them and came back on set with it. My question is whether or not, and I haven't seen a good confirmation or not, one way or the other, as to whether or not the armorer was at the tray with the guns.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was also another aspect was that I saw a report that there was just one live round in the gun. It wasn't fully loaded. It was just one round, which makes me wonder, Alec Baldwin is rehearsing this scene where he's from a seated position, cross draw, aims and fires.
Mm-hmm.
How many times did he do that before the round live round wound up under the hammer?
I've read a report that it was twice. It was the second time.
Which, of course, you know, you're given a gun, you're told the gun is clear, you go through the motions, you draw and pull the trigger and get a click the first time. Why would you expect anything different?
Right.
And that is, you know.
Though that being said, I have not read anything that said that there was just a single live round recovered from his gun. I have heard the police say that they recovered the live round from Alec Baldwin's gun, and which, by the way, has officially been announced as a Pieta copy of a Colt single action Army.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And but I have also heard that the police have in evidence multiple. They have hundreds of rounds in mm-hmm. evidence. Many of which are blanks or dummies, but mm-hmm. they right. have multiple live rounds as well. He was not exactly specific. It was directly asked if there was more live rounds in Alec Baldwin's gun.
He didn't answer.
Yeah,
clearly.
He really didn't answer. He just said he just said that they have recovered more than just that one live round or the spent shell casing. And though one option too could be that he was practicing cross draw, is he may have been drawing and bringing the gun to full cock and then lowering the hammer to do it again. And so in theory, it could be a fully loaded gun and he's not actually dry firing or quote unquote dry firing, because this very much was not a dry gun. And his finger slipped off the, his thumb slipped hammer. Off the hammer as he pulled the trigger, which mm-hmm. had to drop the hammer with enough force to dimple the primer.
Yeah. And there has been confirmed reports that yes, they locked up the guns in the prop van and, you know, had control over that, but didn't have lock up control over ammo.
Yeah.
Which is just one of those. What are you doing?
I'd also like to get a little pedantic about terminology for a moment, because I hear people saying, but it was a prop gun. Like, yes.
Nope.
Yes, it was a prop gun.
It was a prop
gun. Anything used on the set is a prop. It can be a solid rubber duck. It can be a non-firing propane gun, like what you see them all the time. But it could to a fully functioning, real, ready to fire live ammunition firearm. Those are all prop guns because they are used as props in a production.
Yes.
Well, so, okay. Technically, I see what you're getting at.
But that is actually how the I don't know if it's a Screen Actors Guild or whatever the agency that does this. But I have to find that link again. I found a link to their safety directions. Which
includes
several things on firearms.
But prop gun or not, it was a fully functional gun. It wasn't exclusively a prop. It was a prop gun that also was like...
Right, but that's just one type of prop gun. They're all prop guns. It's just like, you know, a prop car. It's still a fully functional car. Or it's just the left half of the car so they can do interior shots.
Yeah.
But it's still a prop car.
The terminology that's being thrown around that makes me grit my teeth...
That was the next thing I was going to address, but go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. I'll let you keep going at it.
That one of them is the fact that they refer to it as a misfire.
Yes.
Which no, it fired. A misfire would not have gone across the room and through two people. It was a negligent discharge. It was not an accidental discharge because the firearm did not malfunction in order to fire. It was a negligent discharge because a human did something that caused the gun to fire.
Well, there was one thing that I didn't mention last time, and I don't know if I didn't know it at the time or if I just didn't think to mention it, but I didn't mention that Alec Baldwin is the producer of this whole mess too.
Yes. Yes.
And that to me adds another level of that makes me think that he is more at fault than otherwise, because there's been a lot of complaints about how shoestring budget it was and how everything was just kind of slapdash put together. And
crew if he's not
just
off.
And if he's not just the actor, but he's also the producer who is in charge, like I'm not 100% on exactly what the role of producer is or isn't, but my understanding is it's you do all the financing, right? So if
you have
they're
a lot
on
a of say in decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like if you're holding the purse strings and your purse strings are the reason why that there aren't adequate safety briefings, there aren't adequate staff, you have an inexperienced and possibly definitely unqualified armorer, that's on you.
Yeah,
and then in addition to being the administrative guy who let this into place, you were also the guy whose hand was on the gun. Like, yes, I can understand how you might expect it to be unloaded, but at the same time, like, you're on both sides of the equation making that situation to where you might want to double check.
Right.
Which is why I preface my statements with Alec Baldwin, the actor, versus Alec Baldwin, the producer. I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for Alec Baldwin, the actor, because regardless of whatever else happened, he pulled a trigger on a gun and someone died, and he's going to have to live with that. And it's going to most likely haunt him for the rest of his life.
Well,
and that's a tragedy.
And also Alec Baldwin, the actor, and this is where I disagree with a number of folks in the community. He was told by two people that are supposed to be knowing what they're doing. Yes, this is a safe cold gun. It is safe for you to pull the trigger on this.
He was, right, but if the scene was a suicide scene and he was going to be putting it against his head and pulling the trigger, I bet you a dollar he would have checked.
But I think he was, depending on the reports, I think he was only told by the assistant director.
Right.
I don't think he was told by anyone else.
But the assumption is that the...
assumption.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, there were a bunch of things that went wrong. But I don't think Alec Baldwin, as an actor, has nearly as much blame for the incident as people are giving him.
If he wasn't the producer as well, I would agree with you.
Right.
But since he was
Alec
the
Baldwin,
producer...
the producer, that's a different story. Because, well, like you said...
Well, okay, fine. Like, one of his multiple personalities shares 20% of the blame, and the other half of his multiple personality... The other multiple personality owns 40%. So, Alec Baldwin, the individual who is both of them, owns, like, 60%. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Oh, no, pieces is, of a puzzle.
But it's the problem of the way I see it is if you start getting there's a certain level where if you start getting into, well, essentially the trigger finger is to blame, well, then we get to the point very quickly where
movies of
this type can't be made.
Yeah, like I wouldn't want this to be like some kind of legal precedent, which is the actor who his hand is on the firearm is ultimately responsible, because like the particulars of the case, in this case being the fact that he was also the producer and partly responsible for the disaster that was the way that movie was apparently run, or at least what looks like a disaster from the outside. Yeah, like I agree with you. Like if we were trying to set like legal precedent or something, then I would say that, yeah, that would be a bad, you would really want to delineate the two.
Right.
So yeah, I get what you're getting at.
You're picking up what he's putting down.
But yeah, since he was producer and everything is pointing at, okay, you had an assistant director that has a history of flaunting safety specifically with firearms. You have a very young, very green armorer who also
has had some reported issues.
Right. And also was apparently doing double duty as assistant elsewhere in the prop department.
Yeah, was basically assistant prop master or whatever.
I'm guessing the fact that the ammo was not locked up in the prop van was because...
Or anyplace else.
Right. Was because she wasn't given the proper facilities to do so.
Quite possibly.
And, I mean, of course, her statement states that she tried to, you know, that there were several things that she tried to insist on, that she was overruled, blah, blah, blah.
And as a young woman in Hollywood?
Yeah, a young woman in Hollywood with Baldwin. Yeah.
It's okay, little girl. We know what we're doing. You just go over there and play.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure a lot of the attitude she caught, no matter who her father is.
Right.
Now, I did find the SAG-AFTRA safety bulletin. I put it in the show notes for future reference for people. And I'm just going to wanted to read a small excerpt. This is from point 11 in the initial safety bulletin. Point 11 is firearms and other weapons. First paragraph. Treat all weapons as though they are loaded and or ready to use. Do not play with weapons and never, underline and bold the word never, point one at anyone, including yourself. Follow the directions of the property master and or weapons handler regarding all weapons. Revised October 17th, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on, but I just, that first paragraph is really the key.
Yeah.
And it goes on.
Something that went into place for sure after Brandon Lee was killed.
I said, it was revised 2002. So that's almost 20 years of that.
Was they made it a point to never again. Obviously I forget the gentleman's name. Hexum, was it?
Yeah, John Eric Hexum.
Yeah, when he died, they made it the point where if the guns aren't currently being used, if the scene's not set up, which case they were resetting a scene, the guns get collected by the armor and get locked up, because you don't want to have bored actors playing around with live firearms, even though they're only loaded with blanks or completely unloaded.
Two additional brief parts of this were: anyone handling a weapon shall receive the proper training and know all operating features and safety devices. If firearms and other weapons are used in filming, the property master and or weapons handler must meet with cast and crew and inform them of the safety precautions in effect and answer any questions.
See, this right here says why there's probably somebody shooting a live firearm for the use of a movie right now, and no one's going to get hurt.
One of the things Sony pointed out was that in 70 years, there have been two on-set firearm-related deaths.
Three? Yep, Hexum, Brandon Lee, and now this.
No, I mean up until this one.
Yes.
Prior to this, there were two in 70 years, mm-hmm. which in almost any industry would be a phenomenal safety.
It really is great. So as much as I come down on how this is going, and especially actually now hearing this and hearing that I was hearing some stuff that was saying essentially the actors always trust the prop department and the blame lies in the prop department, not in the actor for knowing how to safely handle the firearm. It turns out that is not true, which is good.
Yeah. I mean, later on where it gets to the additional part of it, and this is even more, damning for Alec Baldwin actor, is safety bulletin number one within this overall document, general safe use and handling of firearms. Very first point: refrain from pointing a firearm at anyone, including yourself, if it is absolutely necessary to do so, underlined, on camera. Consult the property master or, in his or her absence, the weapon handler and or other appropriate personnel determined by the locality or the needs of the production, or other safety representatives such as the first AD, stage manager. Remember that any object at which you point a firearm could be destroyed. And then it gets into actually the basic firearm rules. Never put your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. Know what and where your intended target is, etc. Never lay down a firearm or leave it unattended. It's on
right, which is another one that, from what I understand, I've seen multiple reports where Yeah, we checked the guns and set up the scene and then broke for lunch and came back.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Which, no, that's not how that should work.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you almost couldn't have engineered a scenario worse for safety.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
You have a producer and an actor who have an open disdain for firearms and firearms owners and mm-hmm. people who know about guns. It's like, you know, kind of like how Aaron talked about as I forget exactly how she tied it to like D&D or something along those lines, but it was like you lose humanity the more you're familiar with guns. You have that guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have a young lady who appears to be. Well, is definitely very inexperienced, probably very prone to being talked over or disregarded, uh-huh. and also might not be very good at what she's doing to begin with, although that has, I guess, yet to be conclusively proven.
And yep. and let's note a production team that would be much happier not to have her in the first place, it sounds like.
Yep. And you have all sorts of conflicts with the crew on the set and the hours and the commute time and all those kind of complaints, and you have people walking off the set, and like you couldn't engineer
a more disastrous
scenario.
This was almost, I'm not saying anything conspiracy theory here, but this could almost have been a scripted worst case scenario.
Yeah. It's like it was overdetermined, you know? Like there were so many things.
I mean, honestly, there were so many red flags.
And there were, like you said, there were enough issues on that set that chances are there was going to be an accident of some sort.
Well, I mean, there were already two accidental discharges. It's just that no one got seriously injured as far as we're aware.
Well, I meant injury. I meant injury, resulting accidents.
Yeah.
Whether it was firearms, whether it was another stunt, whether it was a set collapse,
yeah, and that's one of the big things. Is we were talking a little bit before the show started, but essentially, I mean now I'm starting to think that there's a little bit more. I had not heard that protocol before to realize that. Oh no, like the actors are expected to understand how the firearm works, and so they can exercise the safety. And needless to say, Alec Baldwin has been handling firearms on set for long enough that he at least has a rudimentary knowledge of a firearm. And right.
Or if he doesn't, it's because he's had a concerted effort not to.
Correct.
And I have a harebrained theory about what happened that I have no evidence actually happened, but we know that he was practicing sitting in a pew drawing from a Crossrail holster.
Yep, which means he's sweeping half the room.
And this is a rehearsal. This is not live filming. Yeah. So the fact that he was pointing it at the at the director of photography was not because she was actively shooting him at the time.
Well, there's
another problem with terminology. The whole shooting someone. You know, we're talking about him shooting someone, and you just said, "Well, she wasn't shooting him."
Well, how
do you say, she was not actively operating the camera at that moment? Mm-hmm. Just awkward.
Well,
really he was not filming him.
Yeah, it's just the phrasing is.
Well, there's also the question of. For a lot of people, especially non-gun people, drawing and sweeping the room, it wouldn't occur to them that it is different than pointing the gun at a spot. Mm-hmm. And it is a distinct possibility, like I said, I don't have anything to back this up, but it's a distinct possibility that it may have discharged while he was in the act of drawing it and bringing it around.
Right. Although that safety bulletin point two, never place your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. Keep your finger alongside the frame and off the trigger. And there's a lot of bold and underline in that.
Right. But I've seen experienced shooters set rounds off before they intend to.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so and, like, I, you know, but no, I mean, really, I get what you're saying.
That's for 20 years. This has been part of Hollywood's safety requirements. And various times throughout this document, it mentions that there'll be regular safety briefings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, yeah. And of course, there's also the thing of, David, what's something that is absent in a lot of period holsters for single action revolvers?
Anything covering the trigger?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's not just Westerns. That's all the way through the 30s.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's also, I mean, do we know if this gun was drop safe?
No, because it shouldn't be.
It wouldn't be a transfer bar safety, right?
No, so it was a single action, so it was a fairly
faithful.
Accurate, like it wasn't single action army copy.
Yeah, so it's not going to be one of those modern single action ones that have a transfer bar in there.
Right. On the other hand, a transfer bar only works when it's used properly.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he was actually pulling the trigger.
Right, but I've seen plenty of people lowering the hammer on a Ruger Blackhawk who keep the trigger held down as they're easing the hammer forward.
Right, but I mean, it's also possible that instead of actually pulling the trigger, something struck the hammer. But I mean, I don't think it's terribly likely, in the same way that I think it's unlikely that this accidental shot occurred as he was sweeping the room, just because it would be much more likely for it to miss. You know, like it's certainly
it's
possible, and it could have happened.
Inside a building, it's going to hit something.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm saying that if that happens, you know, 20 times, 18 out of those 20 times, it's going to be a near miss probably, you know, depending on how crowded the room is. Like, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it would be more likely to me that he was actually willfully pointing it in a direction.
Oh, no. I don't think that he was aiming at them. I think he was sweeping them.
No, I know what you're getting at. I'm just saying if I were to sweep a room broadly that is not a movie theater packed with people and squeeze the trigger randomly, most of the time I'm going to not hit a person. I'm going to hit a wall or an object.
Right.
Now, you know the what thing I'm saying? Is, he was in a world in which, you know.
Right, but he was practicing, according to the reports, he was practicing a cross draw and fire towards the camera.
Yeah.
Because that was the scene. Now, according to these safety regulations, you don't actually fire at the camera. There is a mark adjacent to the camera that you fire at, and then they use false perspective or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's part of the safety regulations. So he's doing that. He's drawing and aiming at the mark next to the camera, and they are close to the camera, but not at the mark.
I mean, he's
not aiming at them. He's aiming at the mark. He's just crossing over them as that happens, and he's a little quick on the trigger this second time.
Well, there's also, that may be how they're supposed to do it. Is that what they were doing? Is that one of the things that people were complaining about? The other thing is that mark high and to the right of where this person was standing? And Alec Baldwin does not have immaculate trigger control because he doesn't actually know how to shoot guns, and he just missed. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah, there's
he's going to be pointing within 10. He's going to be pointing within 10 or 20 degrees of a person. Yeah. You know,
and the thing is, these are good questions that we'll almost certainly never know the answers to.
It's like I would be absolutely flabbergasted if Alec Baldwin was actually getting a good sight picture for any of these scenes.
Oh, I don't think he was using the sights at all. I think he was just bringing the gun around in a general direction.
Exactly. So aim at this mark is not going to mean a whole lot, I don't think.
It's more point at this mark.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, I would like to read one more excerpt at this time. There'll be a few others, but this is safety bulletin number. Is this still number one? Yep, safety bulletin number one, item 13. All personnel should remain a set safe distance from the weapon firing area, not point of aim, but weapon firing area, to be determined by the property master or, in his or her absence, the weapons handler and or any other appropriate personnel, determined by the locality or the needs of the production, stunt coordinator and or designated studio safety representative, to ensure personal safety from blank debris and hot ejected blank casings. So blank debris is an arc in front of the muzzle. Nobody should be in the arc in front of the muzzle, according to point 13.
Right.
So regardless of whether he was trying to sweep to that point, they were in the area where he should not have been sweeping that gun, and somebody should have said something because this is part of their safety regulations that they were obviously not following.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Not following reliably.
Well, and what probably happened there.
And that falls on Alec Baldwin, the producer side of things.
Yeah. And probably what happened there is you'll notice that the language always says, or appropriate designated person. Mm-hmm. And how much do you want to bet that the designated person was the assistant director?
Probably. Who had already, as you point, or I think it was you pointed out, mm-hmm. had issues on previous performances.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm turning into a pumpkin, guys.
All right. Good night, pumpkin.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
I set myself up for that one, didn't I?
You little did. Yeah, you did.
All right. All right. Well, I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Yep, yeah, thanks for coming on, Jake.
Good night, Jake.
So, yeah, I think it's all the blame. And again, say what you will about Alec Baldwin and his mental state and where he wants to rest the blame or all of that. It's one thing to be someone who has defended yourself and you were in a deadly force situation and you
like Kyle Rittenhouse.
Correct. we could get to Kyle in just a moment. But in a moment when you were you had to defend your own life and you've shot and killed somebody.
Yeah.
That's
that's one thing.
Yeah, that's one thing. Another thing being, a soldier in a war zone, fighting for the country and killing the enemy. And that is another thing. But this one is just the worst possible way to kill another human being. Because it's not even committing an act of murder. I mean, even that, you could add that, like, it's either premeditated or in hot blood. Crime of passion. This is literally him shooting somebody who he has claimed that he was close friends with and that they had hung out socially and they had a good deal of respect for each other. It was during a rehearsal. It wasn't even a, the Brandon Lee was killed on camera. I think they even used the footage of him dying, in the movie The Crow.
Mm-hmm.
This is literally, he was practicing before they started shooting and the gun fired and hit the director of photography and then hit the director and the director of photography died. And no matter what you may think about Alec Baldwin or all of that, I absolutely bet he wishes he checked those chambers himself before he stuck that gun in his holster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It all boils down to, in this instance, of people not respecting the magical bullet fairy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, and that's a nice lead-in to safety bulletin number 2, special use of live ammunition. This bullet, and by the way, at the top of these bulletins, it says that they shall be issued prior to production. So these are supposed to be posted and distributed to all cast and crew.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them mention sign off. Not going to go looking for that. But these guidelines are intended to give recommendations, special guidelines, and conditions for the safe handling of firearms utilizing live ammunition. Uncontrolled second units, there may be a very rare occasion when live ammunition must be used to obtain an effect. In those very special circumstances, live ammunition may be used only if the following criteria and conditions have been met. And then it lists a bunch of those. And then, including the insurance company, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But then, where was that? On days when the production will be utilizing firearms for live ammunition, firing and have replicas and or a prop firearm, the property master, or in his or her absence, blah, 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 shall identify the live ammunition firearms by color or some other easily recognizable means of identification. These types of firearms shall never be kept together and or stored together. And live ammunition will not be kept on the set for any longer than is necessary to complete the scene in which it is being used. Live ammunition shall be secured in a locked box and clearly marked in a manner to differentiate it from blank ammunition. And various other things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, And then it goes through the general safe use and handling of firearms again. And it's mostly a repetition. But so this, like I said, there's enough blame to go around on this one.
Yeah.
All right. So have we done Alec Baldwin to death for right now? I'm sure there'll be
phrasing.
More. I'm sure there'll be more.
I think so.
Yeah. Sure, and like I said, Alec Baldwin, the actor, if he was an actor completely on someone else's production, I would have nothing but sympathy, because actors are actually discouraged from monkeying with the firearms.
Mm-hmm.
They are given the gun. They are told its condition. They perform their part. So Alec Baldwin, the actor, I am sympathetic to, but Alec Baldwin, the producer, is responsible for everything that goes on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Or during the production. And in that case, he is culpable someday.
And it certainly seems like a lot of the corners that they cut could have really been instrumental in saving a life.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you had mentioned something about Rittenhouse.
Yes. Actually, who was it that was it you, David, that posted this in the show notes?
I put a couple of Rittenhouse links in the show notes. I did.
Well, do you want to take one away?
Take it away from where?
From
you one. Mean reference it? Yes. So the first one is the headline is Rittenhouse defense team implodes hours before jury selection, and it's talking about how one of the defense attorneys who put together a quote dream team of jury selection experts announced he was off the case. And that the change in the defense team means someone is deliberately sabotaging Kyle's defense. Now, it's a fairly short article.
Yeah, and the article you posted, I was a little confused by it.
Okay.
Well, specifically, whether it was Robert Barnes that was saying that he was off the case, or...
Yeah, Robert Barnes says the change in the defense... was from that. Barnes says he was promised that he and his team would be involved in the actual jury selection. The team includes Barnes handpicked, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, Barnes is saying that he has been, that's what it seems to me, is that Barnes is saying that he is not going to be there.
Okay.
That he and his team were not going to be allowed to be present for the jury selection.
Okay. Because this is quite frankly a terribly written article.
Yeah.
I don't disagree, but there are some good clips in it. For example, towards the end of it, experienced use of force experts believe this is a clear-cut case of self-defense, but mm-hmm. Barnes says there's a major PR battle being waged outside the courtroom which could change everything. Barnes says his polling found that 2/3 of the people in Kenosha think Rittenhouse is guilty of the 6 major charges against him. He's worried about the tainted jury pool that could railroad the case, as happened in the hyper-political Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. The Rittenhouse trial begins tomorrow with jury selection, which is what Barnes was to be involved in.
Okay. I guess I guess they failed to put in identifying Robert Barnes as the defense attorney in the first sentence.
Yeah, like I said, it's poorly written, but the information is there. Right. Now, the other article, which I thought was interesting, and this one was posted yesterday. The one about the defense team was posted this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was yesterday afternoon. Headline, the media prepare their readers for a possible Kyle Rittenhouse acquittal.
Well, and for those that don't know, I think we've mentioned Viva Frey. Mm-hmm. Several times in the podcast in the past. He and Robert Barnes actually do a weekly podcast together, or a weekly show together, be it a podcast or an extended YouTube video or whatever you want to call it. And I know that Robert Barnes has definitely talked like he's been very positive about the Rittenhouse case, and has obviously been involved in it, which also meant that there were a lot of things where he had to say, yeah, I can't talk about that.
And did a better job than Alec Baldwin?
Yes. I will be highly interested to see what he says in his own words in the next couple days over that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, another interesting note that Barnes has said on the YouTube channel is that the lethal force witness that they have brought on is Andrew Branca.
Mm-hmm.
Who?
I know that name.
Yeah. Yep. Well, he used to be a sponsor for the Gunblog Variety Cast. He's the Law of Self-Defense is books.
Ooh. Maybe you could get him to make some carefully crafted statements for a special segment.
Mm. And
unless he remembers you, in which case he might not want to talk to you.
We've actually never met, but but yeah, he's been somebody who's set forward. As a matter of fact, actually, in the I remember actually shortly after the shooting in Kenosha. Somebody was speaking ill of Kyle and claiming that the shooting was not justified, and Andrew Branca immediately jumped in and gave a very well thought out point by point rebuttal on any of the accusations there.
Is that printed or recorded somewhere that we can put in the show notes?
I don't want to dig through Facebook. I'm not going to dig through Facebook.
Oh, it was on Facebook.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah, it was on Facebook.
So yeah, never accessible.
And yeah, the prosecutor in that case has definitely tried to play some silly political games with it, up to and including the whole, well, we want to have it publicly released where Kyle Rittenhouse is right now. It's just I think even the judge went, you want to do what?
Yeah. We're going to call the attackers victims.
Right.
So that we can taint things even more.
Yeah. And there have been some things that people have made hay over that say, yeah. Like the whole, the judge has told the prosecutor that no, you're not allowed to refer to the folks that Rittenhouse shot as victims.
You can call them rioters or what was the other one he said? You can call them.
Yeah, I forget what the other term was.
Protesters, rioters or protesters.
You're right. And people have said, well, this shows that the judge thing, this, that, or the other, and it's just, and there's been some lawyers on YouTube that have pointed out that that's actually the defense requested that, but it's also a fairly common request and fairly common for it to be granted in these kinds of cases, just simply because if you refer to the person. You know, in a self-defense case, if you refer to the guy as the person that got shot as the victim, that's tainting the jury's mind into thinking that, well, clearly if he's the victim, then that means that
the other guy's bad.
Yeah. So I'm, and you know, I think, looking at the facts of the case, I think Rittenhouse should already be at home and not dealing with this mess.
Yep.
But politics get involved, and as Barnes was quoted in the article you posted up, there's a lot of people out there that already know deep in their heart that Rittenhouse is guilty of premeditated murder or whatnot, regardless of what the facts are.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm really hoping that he gets off, if for no other reason, because if strictly by the facts of the case, if he's not innocent,
then no defensive shooting is legal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially given the level that this whole thing was documented. I mean, it's, and there is, There was talk. Robert Barnes was talking about it. Obviously, he can't talk about specifics on the case now that he is part of it. But essentially, he was always saying the defense team should immediately be subpoenaing anybody who was there for their cell phone footage, because you could see in the footage that was immediately released, there's lots of other people with their phones up mm-hmm. on this. So there are.
Oh yeah, there's tons of footage, and they've gotten some of it. They've talked about how they've gotten some of it and how the footage will actually really be to Kyle's benefit mm-hmm. because it shows the progress of events and how he was trying to get away until right. he was brought down.
And as he's pointed out, as Robert Barnes has pointed out, the amount of level-headedness that Rittenhouse displayed in.
Oh my God! Yes.
He shot what, three times, and
he fired five rounds, hit three times or four times.
He didn't do what a lot of the trained professionals, yeah. be that police or military, who if they
rounds
were in that
everywhere,
sort of if they were in that situation, he would have unloaded the entire magazine.
Yeah. Well, there's a fellow I knew years back who had served in the Marine Corps in the Mideast.
Mm-hmm.
And, he said, our official orders were X, Y, Z, but our sergeant told us that if there was if they charge the gate,
mm-hmm.
fire till it's empty.
Yeah.
Not over their heads either.
Yeah.
Because Marines, you give Marines a loaded gun and a threat, they're going to Marine.
Right.
Rittenhouse's trigger control, target discrimination, and accuracy were all phenomenal.
Right. Of course, I'm still ticked off at the one guy that he wounded.
The one that had the medic badge and tried to approach Rittenhouse?
Yes.
With a gun in his hand?
Yes. And also showed up to interviews afterwards, still wearing the medic hat.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't there as a medic.
You were.
You weren't showing up to these interviews as a medic or in any kind of condition to be a medic if you needed to be one. I know medics. Mm-hmm. I know EMTs. And they are very big on if they're not on duty, off comes anything that identifies them.
Right. Well, I mean,
not as a, I'm off the clock, don't bother me, but as a
official representative. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, working with a volunteer fire department and associating with a volunteer ambulance company, there really was no off duty.
Right.
So that's where, so it wasn't uncommon for our EMT is, or one of our EMTs, because we had a very high proportion of them at my department, but he'd be at the gas station and somebody collapses, he's going to put on the EMT hat metaphorically.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So there really, like I said, there really is no, I'm off duty. Your problems are not my problems.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the same is true with the professional EMTs that I've known. If there was an incident that happened that medical assistance was needed, they were up and running. But if they were off the clock, they were wanting to make sure that it didn't look like they could have possibly been there on official business.
Right. They're still present. They are still willing to make use of their skills. Of course, they're going to try to save whoever can be saved, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But they're not there primarily for that purpose.
Right.
Whereas this guy, the one who was injured, was claiming to be there for that purpose mm-hmm. by wearing that hat.
Yeah. It's kind of the same as I see the, you know, you go to a gun show and you see the booths selling the police hats, you know, baseball
or the
hats,
the concealed carry badge,
or the concealed carry badge, or yeah, it's no, you are self identifying as a schmuck if you're
you're not wrong.
So you are cosplaying as a medic.
Speaking of schmucks.
There's a segue.
I wanted to put this in. We've gone on for a bit, so I thought we'd go out on a little bit of a lighter note.
Yes.
On the just this morning, I don't know what prompted this, but you know, the host emeritus of the gun blog variety, Sean Sorrentino, just asked me kind of out of the blue, "Hey, whatever happened to Colin Goddard?" For those that may not know that name, because we were actually just discussing Colin Goddard and pointing out the fact that, yeah, he's kind of his 15 minutes have mostly set now, though he pushed it for longer than 15. Is he was a student at Virginia Tech and was shot in the shooting that was at on that college campus. He clearly survived. And went on, he and his father went on to become members of the Brady campaign and worked for the Brady campaign for a number of years. His father, Andrew Goddard, said a whole bunch of awful things. If you want to do some searches for Andrew Goddard Brady campaign quotes, you'll find some really, really nasty and unprofessional things that he said while he was a chapter president. I believe it was the Virginia chapter president there. And then Colin eventually, it has many activists did jump ship from the Brady campaign and joined Everytown when Michael Bloomberg really started throwing his weight around with his new anti-gun group. While he was under Everytown, he did talk with President Obama. I believe I quoted him in the gun. I sampled him in the gun blog variety cast in my month long fisk of the Obama gun control town hall that he did for CNN. And then he disappeared. His name came up several years ago and I went, huh, Colin Goddard. Yeah. I haven't really heard about him. I haven't seen him make any statements or anything like that. I wonder what's still going on. And so I did a quick search and it turned out, let's scroll down. In 2016, he left Everytown for Gun Safety. I'm looking at his LinkedIn page right now. He was the senior policy advocate. And then he went on to, several other, positions until in 2018, which was when I actually was, wondered where he was. He ended up becoming the director of Zero Mass Water, of which immediately I went, that name sounds familiar. And the science VTuber on YouTube, Thunderfoot, covered this group as essentially as a scam that was bilking investors out of money for essentially a product that's not going to work. And needless to say, the essentially how the technology.
I'm shocked, I say, to find there's fraud going on here.
Yeah. For those that didn't watch that video or just want to hear the basic statement of it, essentially how Zero Mass Water works is they advertise themselves as being able to produce clean drinking water simply out of the air using no external power sources. And so essentially this unit is a specially designed solar cell that is essentially running a dehumidifier. And so the solar cell is powering the compressor that is running a condenser that condenses water, and the water that collects on the along the refrigeration coils then drips down into a collection basin where it can be used for drinking. And there is a number of problems. The lesser problem of that is that it is very, very difficult to keep all of these parts clean, and you don't want to be, unless it's an absolute emergency, drinking the water out of your dehumidifier, if you have one. But
all one, and I've seen that water.
Yeah. But the bigger issue is that dehumidifiers, and you can't hear it now, but I will be editing the sound of my dehumidifier out of the background of this audio track. Because I'm in my basement, and it's been a wet year, and so just keeping the humidity out. Dehumidifiers work beautifully in high humidity environments, and they produce a lot of liquid. And as the humidity drops, the efficiency and liquid produced also drops because there is no water to pull out of the air, and so therefore, in any area where these zero mass water units are producing a lot of drinkable water, tends to be areas that have high humidity, therefore also high amounts of rain, and also by nature, generally a water table that's easily accessible by standard well drilling techniques.
Mm-hmm. And or because there are various types of condensers for humid environments that already exist to mm-hmm. condense water out of the air.
Yes.
Right.
You know, if it's a humid environment, that's full.
Yep. And meanwhile, if you were to take this out to, say, the Mojave Desert and try to, you know, run this, according to this, Goddard is based out of Washington, D.C. With
shocking.
Yeah. With this, but the zero mass water is headquartered in Scottsdale, Arizona. If you are to set this unit up in Scottsdale, you are going to have very, very diminishing returns because it's a desert. And there is very, 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 as they say, it's the dry heat. It is very mm-hmm. little humidity in the air. So therefore, no matter how cold you get those coils,
There's no water to condense.
Yeah, there, or at least very, very precious little. And even then, unless the system is very, very well isolated, it is going to dry itself up the moment it condenses. So yeah, this system is one that, unless they have some really, really amazing breakthroughs, and since nobody's really heard about them very much, they probably do not. This seems to be very much a shady business to invest in. And to further add to the shadiness, it turns out, like I, again, Sean asked me this morning, hey, whatever happened to Colin Goddard? And I went and hopped on his LinkedIn profile because I actually forgotten the name Zero Mass Water and looked it up and saw, oh, Source Global. What is Source Global? And I clicked on, you know, Source Global, and Source is technology providing safe, clean drinking water for industrial, commercial, residential, and community applications. Ground digging hydro panel taps endless supply of solar energy and moisture.
This sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes. And so, and then, you know, the website is source.co, and going to Zero Mass Water, interestingly enough, it is pretty much the same byline, and Zero Mass Water's website is source.co. It is simply just the company name has changed, and Goddard updated his resume to reflect the name of the new company name.
Now, as I've mentioned before, that's a standard on LinkedIn because LinkedIn doesn't have a way to show mm-hmm. two company names for the same employment.
Mm-hmm.
So on that, in that respect, I'm not saying any less of charlatanism, but just for listing that on LinkedIn, that's the way it goes.
Yep. And I, all I am implying here is either whoever is in charge of Source Global, which does it say where it's based out of? Scottsdale, Arizona. Okay, so
they can test that there.
But well, the Zero Mass Water is also based out of Scottsdale. So it would certainly be one thing if, you know, some, you know, Con Huge Co. saw the technology and said this is an interesting tech, like Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation saw this, and this seems like something Bill Gates might be interested in. Gates Foundation saw this and they wanted to secure the technology so that they could possibly use it to get fresh water in Africa, whatever. So if the Gates Foundation had bought them and created a new company with the Zero Mass Water IP, that'd make a lot of sense. But this really reeks of fly by night, like mm-hmm. of a shell game. And the whole reason why I'm getting into this is just for a little good-natured character assassination in pointing out that essentially he has gone from one con in telling people that banning guns is going to make you safer to now telling people that, hey, this solar panel in the desert, which solar panels work wonderful in the desert, it's going to produce a lot of power, is going to also produce drinking water in the desert in an appreciable amount.
Mm-hmm. So I just tripped over news to me incident that might be of interest.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Gainesville Sun, there was a gun buyback.
Yeah.
I did hear this.
And apparently, according to the Gainesville Sun, it was sponsored by the state attorney's office, the Gainesville Police Department, the Save Our City organization, and the gun shop Big Daddy Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
For those that don't know, Big Daddy Unlimited has been trying to position itself. I don't know if it's their actual tagline, but a lot of the YouTubers that they've been sponsoring have been likening them to the Sam's Club mm-hmm. of the gun world, where you pay a membership and can buy things with discounts. But yeah, apparently Big Daddy Unlimited actually sponsored and possibly put up use of facilities for a gun buyback.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure is going to go well for them.
I overheard when I heard about this story, I overheard that they gave a statement. I don't have it offhand. I don't know if either one of you can dig it up, but allegedly they were saying that they were at the gun buyback and they were there, but rather than them being part of the purchasing and or destroying guns, which was, by the way, was that right off the top of my head? Was that Benchmade was destroying guns a few years ago. Were those buyback guns or were those evidence guns?
Those were seized evidence guns where the cases had been closed, from what I remember.
Yeah, so they were in the possession of the police department, and either from the police's determination, owner's determination, or court order, those guns were supposed to be destroyed.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is, I know of a number of departments in different parts of the country where seized guns, guns that are turned in, guns that have been, their whatever criminal case has been resolved and they no longer keep for evidence, instead of destroying them, they sell them.
Yeah.
They sell them in lots to local gun shops who then will go through and resell them.
With I want to say checks. That's actually the law in Tennessee, but...
That they have to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. I mean, in some states, it's the law that they have to destroy them.
Yeah.
No matter what. There was someone was telling me, I forget which state it was, might have been New Jersey, was that any gun seized in a crime, blah, 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 had to be destroyed. Even if it was stolen and they could identify the original owner it was stolen from.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't return it to the owner who'd lost his property.
Crazy.
Yep.
Yep. But yeah, the idea of course, obviously the gun goes and needs to be sold with a background check since they would only transfer them to FFLs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead.
And I was going to say, and then when the FFL sells it, there's another background check.
Correct.
Because there's the not really a check, but there is the paper trail of the FFL who purchased them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lot of them, I should say. And then when that FFL sells them retail, there is again the paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the state, because some states, if you have an HCL, you don't have to get the background check.
Yeah.
And other states have figured out a way to make money off of Tennessee. Yeah.
And of course, you know, anybody knows. I mean, Oddball was looking at a Raven 25. Which was being sold for a decent. What was the price? It was being sold?
$70.
$75. Yeah,
75
for a used piece of garbage 25 auto,
and
pot metal gun, and so even that cheap, you know, gas station knife of guns quality is still worth $75 at a pretty decent discount. Guns are inherently valuable. And they're inherently durable, and the idea of a police department, which police departments are always in want for more funds and more supply and capital, the idea that you would then turn around and destroy something and sell it for scrap metal at, you know, pennies on the dollar,
mm-hmm.
right.
is just wasteful and ridiculous, especially when you note that when you dispose of the guns to a gun shop, those guns are going out as a gun with a background check.
Yep. Of course, you also know that any firearms that are turned in at one of these quote unquote buybacks, anything particularly nice is not getting to the smelters.
Mm.
Somebody's got to get a nice addition to their private collection.
Chances are, yeah.
And of course, also many of these gun buybacks are being patrolled by gun owners who have done massive withdrawals of cash before they went, so they could be like,
yep.
"Oh, it's $150 for that gun. I'll give you $200 for it right here.
Cash.
Not a gift card. Cash right here, right now. You give that to me."
So in the article that I posted, it does say that. Big Daddy owner Tom McKnight was giving away safes for individual guns and gun locks,
which is fine.
Yeah, and the one quote that they have from McKnight in this article is quote, "It's a community service on us." It's a community service for us on responsible gun ownership. Which, I mean, giving away the gun, the individual gun safes, which I'm sure are the cheapo lock boxes, but at least that's something.
Yeah.
So
as long as there's not a mandate that the guns have to be stored in the lock boxes.
Right. But to have your name anywhere near sponsoring a buyback is not a good look for a gun company.
Mm-hmm.
No. Now, if they were the ones, you know, if the guns were not slated for destruction, but it's like, you know, we've partnered with local law enforcement or whatever, and if you have guns you want to dispose of, bring them in and we will give you a gift card to our store.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's like, well, that's basically a gun on trade item, but they're just phrasing it that way. But
and let's be honest, so The initial statement of a gun buyback is that the criminals who have guns so they can get, you know, they can rob and steal from people and all that can just get money for the guns, which itself is pretty ridiculous because if they wanted to sell the gun on the street, they could get, you know, 3 to 5 times the amount of money for it as they could in the buyback. But the big people that end up showing up for this are older people who are no longer shooting.
Right. Or their widow or widower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had We actually were fortunate. Was an older woman whose husband had passed away. She came in because she wanted to get his guns appraised, and she brought them into the store to do that. Of course, the funnier one was a woman came in. She had several large bags of handguns that she wanted to get appraised, and they were her husband's guns. And as we're chatting, the story comes out is, yeah, he's out of town with his girlfriend that she just found out about.
Oh.
And so she's getting them appraised so they can accurately be represented in the divorce proceedings.
Oh.
Damn. Mm-hmm. Good for her, though.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that's...
And she's doing the right thing.
Leave a mark.
I was thinking you were going to say that, yeah, she was planning on selling them. But nope,
because they're not technically... I mean, they're married, so they're... I don't know what the law is, but they may be considered her property as well.
Right, actually doing the straight and narrow of the, yeah, I want the appraisal so I know what to go after them in court with.
Yup. It's like, wow. So we're all just standing there talking, and she lets that one drop. And a couple of us were looking at the guns and trying to get her the numbers, just kind of looking at each other like, whoa, okay. keep looking these up.
And, yeah, we might bump these a little on the high side.
No, we also want to do the straight and narrow thing.
Well,
like, okay, yeah. This one looks like somewhere between 90 and 95%. Let's just call it 95%.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's what I meant.
And we also did the proper thing of asking, like, you know, does he have the boxes that these came in and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, yeah, so those were two store incidents that probably be good things to toss in a gun shop stories segment.
Absolutely.
But the widow who is coming in with her husband's, because that was just sad.
Yeah.
Because they were his, he had owned some of them for a very long time, some of them more recently, and she wasn't interested in them, but she didn't know what to do. You know, yeah. There was no close family that he left them to. They were left to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wanted to make sure that she got reasonable value.
Yeah.
So I think that does the show nicely.
I think we should find something positive to end after the widow bringing in her late husband.
Well, we could point out the fact that NYSERPA versus the New York Attorney General is going to be heard this week. They'll already have heard opening arguments by the time either the patrons or the regular listeners are hearing this. So we'll mm-hmm. definitely be talking about that next week.
Yes, and Weird, have you spotted anything interesting on Primary Arms' website?
It's Monday. He doesn't need to look at that till Saturday.
Ryan pulled it on me again, and I thought he wasn't going to ask, and I actually had the website open to scare him away, and then I closed it, and then he asked me.
So now you know, for the next episode of Handgun Radio, you have that browser tab open, and it stays open until you sign off.
Correct. Until I sign off. Oh, but yeah.
I don't know what the proper terminology for.
Mm-hmm.
Thought it was
so
sign off.
Just it's sign off. Yeah. No, yeah, I'm just laughing on the fact that once we get into the main body of the show, we're not going to be talking about what's on sale at Primary yeah. Arms.
Once he gets past the plug.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm saying goodnight to the internet.
All right.
Okay.
So. I think that wraps up the show, and I'd like to thank each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up, and you guys can hear the show early. That's kind of cool. But what's really cool is you can get the blooper reels. And by the way, that's also getting you the back catalog as well. So you're not just getting whatever the next blooper reel is and they're on it thereforth. No, you can go in and you can listen to hundreds of blooper reels, which is awesome.
Or terrifying.
Or terrifying. And also we have at our highest level, the ACP Mag Dump, which we get, you get all the previous the previous stuff, the ACP film tracks, the early release, and all that, plus a bonus show that is like this but is uncensored and not necessarily firearms related. So I would like to also thank our peanut gallery. First up, we will thank those who are not here, but you know what, they're here in our hearts, both Aaron Paulette and Jake the Egghead. You guys are also Xander, of course. I was hoping he would hop on. He hopped on chat real quick, but yeah, he's been working like crazy, and just has not had the acumen to log the late nights. And of course, we have David.
Hello, folks. Thank you for joining us again. I'm here. I'm occasionally on Handgun Radio, which I'd like to be a guest on again. And I also do posts on bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com.
And we have Oddball.
And I just realized I haven't bought a knife or a crappy gun all month.
Well, you need to buy that Raven.
I guess that would be a good way to reward myself for not buying a gun all month.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun way to learn about clearing jams.
And I was
just as a reminder to our listeners, this is being recorded on November 1st. Mm-hmm. Just in case they didn't quite get follow that.
I was invited on Handgun Radio once, and they never wanted me back. So,
I mean, it's true. He's pretty good on this show. He was awful on Handgun Radio.
Oh,
not true. Oh, so all right, and Aaron does the outros better than I do, and so's our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night, folks.